Welcome to All Things Policy, a daily podcast by the Takshashila Institution. We are a bunch of policy nerds based in Bengaluru, and we like bringing fresh perspectives to Indian affairs and Indian perspectives to global affairs. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and join us for today's chat. Hello and welcome to All Things Policy. I'm Manoj Kevalramani, and today I have with me my colleague Rohan Seth. And we're going to be talking about the information ecosystem around the COVID-19 pandemic. Specifically, we're going to be talking about misinformation. Now, this is not a new subject. We've discussed this in the past, and we've sort of had a conversation about how, say, specifically in the context of India and China, this misinformation ecosystem has played out. But there's a sort of broader issue at stake here. One is about how states are competing in terms of misinformation, and the other is far more fundamental. That's about how we value information, we as consumers, we as individuals. We've got plenty of news channels and news platforms around. There's lots of social media. And a lot of our conditioning is to have all this information available to us for free. So we're going to try and discuss all of this. Rohan, I'm going to begin with sort of asking you about this new op-ed that you've written. Tell me what your core argument is.
So the core argument in my op-ed last week was that the idea is that information generally should now be perceived as a commodity, given that, you know, this whole pandemic is causing a lot of people to spread a lot of misinformation. We've seen a bunch of spectacular consequences of this misinformation just gone wrong and people acting based on this. So we see that in the UK and in the Netherlands, people are actually they've received information that 5G cell towers are now spreading COVID-19. So they go on to start burning these cell towers. In Indore, Indian Express ran a report that said that certain Muslim communities in Indore got information that doctors are actually coming to inject them with coronavirus. So we see this result in a huge negative consequence, because when doctors enter into these areas, they get attacked. So we see that information is so valuable because we act on whatever we know. And that is sort of the core argument behind my article. So we need to see information as a commodity, and we need to start sort of treating it as such by paying for it, not by our privacy, but in actually monetary terms. Because generally, it might seem counterintuitive to pay for information these days, but historically, we've been doing that. A lot of us have been subscribers to newspapers, and it's a similar concept, right? When you receive a newspaper, information is sort of curated for you, and most of what you read is credible. Quality journalism has a certain value attached to it, something that your WhatsApp feed doesn't necessarily have. That's what I talk about.
So let's just try and unpack this by first looking at the misinformation ecosystem around the pandemic. So we've had, obviously, there's a big controversy with regard to the origin of COVID-19, which is, you know, there's been so much disinformation around that from both, not just states, so the US, China, but also from other sort of players. There was a recent study that came out from the EU, which is very critical about the Chinese and the Russian sort of attempts to manipulate information around the pandemic to suit their needs. And there is different forms of this, right? So one is where you try and seed doubt. Another is where you try and forcefully put together your point of view on something. So the seeding doubt could be in the context of, oh, X doctor, X study says that this came from this lab and this lab was studying something like that. Or like how the Chinese have been doing that. Well, there are so many cases in US Navy vessels. So was this a virus that the US soldiers were carrying around? Likewise, you could do something where you actually talk about, say, how you've managed to contain this virus, and that might not reflect the reality, but your numbers actually start to create a perception that, oh, actually the curve's flattened and things have improved. So there are many ways in which this can play out. What are some of the most damaging ways? Like you've spoken about the case where there was WhatsApp information about, you know, doctors intending to go and inject people with the virus as opposed to actually protecting them. And that was a bunch of nonsense. But it had an impact. What are some of the other ways that you've seen some of this misinformation play out?
I think this is down to more of a value judgment than anything else. But the sort of the most let's say low grade way, but highly pervasive one that I've seen is how misinformation translates into perceptions. So the idea is that two people can interpret the same piece of information very differently, right? So let's say I get a notification on WhatsApp saying that this virus is a bioweapon developed by China, and it went, the whole experiment went completely awry. And the idea was that this bioweapon leaked and China was infected first, and then now China is basically crashing. So the way I would interpret this misinformation or this particular piece of information is that I would immediately go for a fact-checking source and to see whether there is any credible claim to the fact. Whereas a lot of people would not be as, let's say, skeptical as I am. They would generally assume that this goes, you know, in line with the Chinese character. I think you can elaborate more on that. But generally, they would say that the Chinese people are not trustworthy, and this fits in nicely with that narrative. So this largely makes sense. And so low-grade perceptions pervade sort of into society at scale. So a lot of people who sort of have similar mindsets will be able to come to this, you know, internalized myth that this was created by China. And as a result, you know, it sort of, I would say, depreciates the value of discourse that flows within societies. And that, to me personally, seems like the most damaging way that misinformation affects us.
That's an interesting point that you make, right? So at the end of the day, for any of this to be effective, it has to play on existing perceptions and biases. And depending on where you stand in that spectrum on a particular issue, a particular piece of information will feel far more accurate. You will feel far less the need to actually go and verify it, because it will feed into the kind of perceptions that you already hold. I mean, the Chinese example that you gave. And likewise, say, for example, if somebody who is, say, extremely religious or who believes in certain things like, you know, vibrations around you can change nature of energy and whatever. To them, misinformation with regard to the virus in terms of, you know, sounds, lights, whatever, you know, having certain kinds of incense burning will create a difference. Those things will appeal far more and seem far more real and truer, as opposed to somebody saying that, look, you know, sanitize your hands 5 times a day or every time you go out or things like that. Those fixes will seem far more real. So it sort of plays into existing biases that exist in society, and therefore sort of you've seen some of the more communal tensions in India, right?
Yeah, that, and also broadly I would say that we see similarities here in the way the US and India have also sort of reacted to different pieces of misinformation. So I'm not sure how aware, you know, everyone is, but in the US, Trump has been sort of talking about cures that are not necessarily cures, right? He's talking about how drinking bleach could cure the virus, or how a bunch of different, I don't even know all of that. Hydroxychloroquine was one of them as well. And so
the simplest way to say that is HCl.
Yes, okay, I'll go with that. So HCl. But regardless, I think... So there's been a bunch of hoax cures from the US, and in India, people have also followed suit. So if you remember back when the virus was still, you know, not as prevalent, there was a theory that come summer, the virus is basically going to die out because it can't handle the heat. And because India has, you know, tough summers, it's not going to spread in India. So scientists repeatedly kept saying that we do not have enough information to say that this statement is true. But at the same time, you remember when our Prime Minister talked about lighting candles and as a support to healthcare workers. I'm not sure what the messaging behind that was, but I imagine it was to support healthcare workers.
Yeah, I mean, that was that the lighting candles was to largely do with essentially communicating with each other that we're in this thing together and there will be light at the end of the tunnel. Essentially a hopeful message as opposed to anything else.
On WhatsApp, at least it got translated into a way that this is a masterstroke, because if you light enough candles, the temperature will rise by 9 degrees or something of the sort. And because of the rising heat, the virus will die. So you see, there is sort of this paradigm where already there was an existing myth that high temperatures kill the virus. So anyone who's read that and now notices that lighting a candle raises temperatures, so this makes things hard for the virus, there's already an existing predisposition to the fact that that heat kills the virus. So when you hear something like a candle being a masterstroke by Modi, you don't argue against it. You don't go to Google to check whether or not it actually kills the coronavirus. And even though you see that summer is now broadly here, at least in North India, so you realize that the pandemic still isn't over. And that immediately doesn't strike you, you know, sort of against the belief that heat doesn't kill the virus. You just don't notice it unless someone specifically brings it out to you and says that, look, you thought about this, but it's definitely not true because summers are here and the virus is showing not a lot of signs of slowing down. So I think that's just hugely interesting.
And one of the challenges of all of this is the fact that this is new, right? This is the novel coronavirus. It's new. We don't really know much about it. And any of these processes where you do tests and you start finding out things, you understand the structure, and you sort of figure out what works, what doesn't work, how the virus behaves, how it mutates. All of these things usually take years. They don't happen very quickly. And in this sort of an environment where, you know, science is still catching up, it's very easy for some of these things to actually spread. And for you to even be able to say with authority that, so for example, like you said, at the moment, we still don't know whether, you know, temperatures have an impact. We still don't know whether the virus reacts differently with different ethnicities. Because there were reports in, say, Britain where, you know, people of Asian ethnicities, Indian origin, South Asians, were adversely affected by the virus, much more so than others. I don't know what credibility there is in that report, but or what sample surveys are there and whatever. But because we don't know enough about the virus in terms of how it behaves, because it is so new, it's very easy for more of this to spread. And it's very easy, it's very difficult to actually debunk some of this stuff, right?
So this basically brings us perfectly into the segue of how we get our information matters and generally about the information diet that we have, right? So according to me, and this is something that I've been feeling for the past few months now, I have become a lot more conscious of the information I consume. And because I realize that it matters how credible your facts are, because anytime you talk to someone and say that I read this somewhere, it's not a credible sort of start to your statement. So having said that, I would say that in the way you get your information matters, because a lot of people, especially in India, get the information from WhatsApp. A lot of people, a lot social media, are very high sort of stature in the information diet. So, and again, it's sort of makes sense as well, because social media is great at building narratives. So if you look at stuff on Twitter, you get your information through WhatsApp. It's frictionless because it's free. You consume a great narrative. And most of the time, you don't actually have to go online to get that media, get the information, because information sent to you through push notifications, right? There's little to no friction. Information comes to you without you actually asking for it. So that's a pretty good thing to have in an ideal world where most information on the internet is credible. But as anyone who has surfed the internet can tell you, the internet is not filled with a lot of truth, right? So we get all of this information sent to us through WhatsApp. And because we allot such high value to these platforms in our lives, in our information diet, it's a problem. This is where newspapers win over traditional social media, right? And you've been a journalist, so you can confirm or deny what I'm about to say next. But so the idea is that there is a lot of effort put into validating a story by fact-checking it multiple times to making sure that it goes to the right people, it's curated well. And there's a lot of thought that goes into preparing, let's say, a single page for a newspaper. It's something that people sending you forwards on WhatsApp don't do. People sending you forward on WhatsApp don't check whether or not the source is credible. Whereas an editor is more likely to do that because that's his job. And this is why I sort of make the argument for being more conscious of what you consume. Because there is so little friction, you don't realize how much, let's say, garbage you are consuming without actually noticing it. So garbage in, garbage out applies here, right? And so newspapers are a pretty good way of avoiding all of that.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that there is that there exists distrust of mainstream media. Whether it's because of television, print, however, there exists sort of distrust of mainstream media within not just India, but even in other countries. This is a problem that persists. Now, and there's a lot of belief that, you know, like when I talk to people who consume a lot of their content on WhatsApp, or on television also. There are two kinds of beliefs. One is that if it they don't firstly distinguish between WhatsApp or other forms of social media as being user generated. Coming here, that means it must be, somebody must have looked at it.
Yeah.
So that inherent sort of thing exists because you feel that otherwise, why would it come here? So I have this conversation quite frequently with my father, and my father's eventual response to me is that, but then why is it being sent to me? And I keep telling him that, look, I can sit here and right now create gibberish and it may go viral. But that doesn't mean that it's true. And somebody will forward it because somebody just thought it was, you know, whatever. And they sort of sent it to you. Or somebody just sitting out of habit. So firstly, that sense of, you know, why is it that it's not curated content, it's user generated and anybody can create whatever and it can work. Secondly, the lack of trust within mainstream media. So at the same time, the sort of the lack of interest in verifying what's coming on WhatsApp or other platforms is one. And the second is that, well, if it's coming on the news, I don't exactly know what their biases are. And I don't exactly know whether they are entirely trustworthy, because at the end of the day, these people are all in there for in there as a business and whatever.
Yeah.
And that's partly to do with also how mainstream media in India and maybe in other parts of the world also have conducted themselves over the years. They've shown themselves to be partisan. There has been lots of questions about how sting operations, etc., have been conducted in the last month. We've heard that.
Yeah.
So that sort of creates this sense of, well, these guys can't be trusted. And here, because there's a face to that, what I can see, you know, I know whom not to trust. But on WhatsApp, it's faceless, it's nameless. So I don't know motivations and I don't think of motivations of people who might have started some trend. So therefore, I don't think enough deeply. So that's another sort of strand to that. But your broader argument of how we value information, it sort of takes me back to nearly a decade ago. In 2011, I had written a piece which said, why news isn't a pair of Levi's. The argument was that, look, it is a commodity. But it's a different commodity. It can't be customized to your needs and suit you. You need to look at uncomfortable things also and look for more things also. And you need to realize that you also need to put your money where your mouth is. And some of that has happened, right? So, for example, at least in we subscribe to newspapers, but a lot of online platforms are moving to subscription. In the West, this is much more prominent than in India. But our television news channels, a significant number of them have moved to paid models. So I pay for more on DTH for each channel mm-hmm. that I buy. But previously, I didn't. So in the last couple of years, this change has happened where I individually pick the channels, news channels that I want, which may be good or bad, right? Sort of can end up in an ecosystem where I can only listen to one type of information, and that might be terrible. So therefore, there's a little bit of choice that we need to fork out more money for diversity, but also for credibility.
So my general argument, and I just want to, before I move on to my argument, I want to say is that was the opposite of an endorsement for Levi's. As calling them uncomfortable is probably the last thing they would have wanted in all things policy.
No. The argument was that you don't need to look for something that is comfortable and that fits you. Look for something that is uncomfortable, unlike a Levi's.
If anyone from Levi's has signed in and is listening, we would want to extend our sincere apologies. So my main contention with that is, I agree that even news media is not credible, right? We've seen that. I'll take for an example. We've seen that with Fox News, and in the US and in India, depending on where you stand on the ideological spectrum, you've probably seen that with either News 18 or Republic TV, right? Look at the fact that these are politically biased people. But generally, what I sort of come to the conclusion of is that if you are still paying for that media, it is still a step above from receiving your news from WhatsApp, because that's just how bad WhatsApp is. If you're actually paying for the stuff that you are consuming in terms of information, at least that stuff, there will be a certain degree of curation to that stuff, as well as a certain degree of fact checking. You can disagree with the curation and say that, let's say, Republic TV will curate your feed in such a way that it sort of omits a bunch of stuff, or that News 18 will curate your feed in such a way that it omits a bunch of other stuff. Sure. But curation is still part of the process. And just to uphold the credibility, these organizations have to at least have some level of fact checking, which is automatically a level above what WhatsApp and Twitter will do to you. And there are so many instances over the past few, let's say, years, I would say ever since these platforms have started, that tell you that none of this is happening on them. And also, the other argument here is that if you are paying for the news, it automatically means you are at least valuing the information you consume a little bit better. So you're more cautious with what you take in. Instead of just going onto Twitter and using it as a news service and not being sort of cognizant of what you have read. So that to me is just this, it's a priceless value that it has. So I would still say that WhatsApp is a rung below.
Okay, so I'm going to summarize what we've just talked about. We've talked about the idea that as individual consumers, we need to put a premium and value on the information that we are consuming. There's lots of information out there. We've got limited time and mind space. So put a premium and value on what you're consuming. Look at more curated platforms, because user-generated content, while maybe great in some cases, can be quite problematic unless you actually go and verify all of it. Don't believe everything you read on WhatsApp and every place else. Even when you're looking at curated content, whether it's television, print, or however else, look at credibility. Examine with critical eye and try and incorporate some degree of diversity in what you're reading, so that you get different points of view to the same thing, because you don't want to be cocooned within your own ecosystem. And lastly, in terms of WhatsApp and these other platforms, there's a whole Pandora's box of regulation that can be brought into place, which Rohan and I will not talk about right now, although I'll mention it and tickle Rohan. That's called intermediary liabilities.
Oh my God. time to extend this podcast.
And someday we'll sit and talk about that also and how that plays a role. But at least for today, when it comes to the information that you're receiving in and around the pandemic, listen to the experts, listen to the government on laws, norms, regulations with regard to the lockdown and what can be and what can't be opened and how you should be moving around. Don't believe kooky ideas that you read just because they may seem convenient or they reflect some of your preconceived biases. Some reflection would help. I guess that captures everything, right?
Yeah, and as people burning 5G towers in the UK will tell you, misinformation matters. So, yeah,
don't burn 5G towers, they're damn expensive. Okay. Thanks so much for listening to us. Thanks so much, Rohan.
Hey, thank you.
If you liked our show, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can tune into them on the IVM podcast app, ivmpodcast.com, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also follow IVM on social media. The handle is @IVMPodcasts on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And hey, if you'd like to dive into Takshashila's research on technology, strategy, and economic affairs, check us out at our Twitter handle @TakshashilaInst or our website, takshashila.org.in.